Yay. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Pony Development Sync for August 30th, 2017. We have a good group here today. We got Theo, Joe, Gordon, Benoit, Sylvan, and myself, Captain Mysterio. Alrighty, let's start with some PRs. How about we start with PR 2190? This is an RFC implementation of Improve InterTools API that Theo has done.
It's great. Sorry, I have nothing else to offer. It's great.
I just realized, Sylvan, if we merge this, then I have something to put in last week in Pony.
Indeed. Something rather good.
Indeed. Anybody have any objection to merging this? Has everybody had a chance to look at it? I'm going to take that as a we should hit the button.
Hit the button.
Hit the button. Hit the button. Okay.
Press the button, Sean. Press the
button. Okay, I'm going to press the button. Yay! All right, boom. That's one. Okay. Next up for PRs, you're still working on the Lambda inference, right, Joe? We skip over that for now?
Yeah, I just posted a comment there before this call started. There's a deeper refactor I have to do Money Stable uncovered. Hey, it's not going to be too bad. Basically, I need to refactor so that I'm storing stuff in the type check frame on the way down rather than recursing up through parentage at the bottom.
Okay.
So I guess next one is 2194. That's Gordon's disallow calling method of a type union whose parameter names differ. It looks like there is some conversation on there between Joe and Gordon.
Yeah, I think I've found a way to make it more restrictive so that only if there's a call with named arguments, then it will complain.
Ah, right. Whereas with unnamed arguments,
you can still have different names.
Cool. All right. That's excellent.
So this is passing the check, so I slapped a do not merge on it for
now? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just so nobody accidentally does it. And then you can take it off when it's good.
Cool.
All righty then. Next would be, this is one of Benoit's. It's 2200, add coalescing of message sends.
Very interesting.
And you're going to have to, words. My words are failing me. Benoit, you're going to need to rebase against master because you have a conflict with the changelog.
Yeah, okay, I'll do that.
Let's see.
Wait a minute here. So this adds.
I love this name, well formed message chain.
What's wrong with that?
No, I love it. It's a great name.
Oh, okay. Yay for not taking VARs.
What's ndebug?
That ndebug is defined if you are not building debug.
Why like, so for my edification in actor.c, for example, there's a atomic store explicit on line 386, which is in a not defined end bug. Why would
So that only gets done in the release mode. So we're only going to slap null in message next in release mode.
Why?
No, it should be the other way. Which line is it?
No, sorry. Oh, it's only in debug mode. I apologize. It's if ndef end debug.
Right. Yeah, it's actor C line 386. But why only in debug?
Because we need that node to for the checks on the message chain. But since we are if we assign it there in a pony unlock message in release mode, it's going to be suboptimal because I don't remember exactly why, but I did some tests with the assembly code, and it's more optimal to do it in message queue push.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I'm just going through implementation. This is quite interesting. So for this is great. So we simply put last on the queue. We've already assembled the linked list before doing this. And we store first into next. This is great. I have a favorite part about this, though, which is that this is zero cost for a single message. It's lovely.
Well, is it a bigger, I don't want to quarrel too much, but is it a slightly larger stack? Would you be sending another argument?
Yeah, but you won't notice.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking too. I just wanted to, maybe it's like a 0.0001 top.
That's good point. Yeah.
And if you use the runtime BC compiler option,
it'll all go away.
It will be in line, then it will be truly zero cost.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that makes sense.
So I don't know if anyone has looked in genopt.cc.
Yes, many times.
Okay, no, I mean for this change. Thanks,
oh no! Remember the part where we were talking about being tired?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Oh yes. All right. Yeah. Okay. Let me go look.
But there's some quite neat stuff here. For merging message sends, as an optimization pass. And if anyone is interested in optimization passes that are pony specific as opposed to general LLVM optimization passes, this is my new favorite example of a pony specific optimization pass.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I was thinking, I don't know, at some point it might be nice to have a little bit more like kind of code comments in there about what's going on in some of these big functions. But I mean, you can kind of, you know, read it and get the context, but it would be cool to maybe have some more documentation about somebody who's interested in learning about it, come in and take a look.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Definitely nothing that would block this from getting merged.
Yeah, of course, but it's still a good point.
I can actually, so here, I'm going to resolve the, I'm resolving the conflicts.
Oh, was there a, okay.
So you don't have to, Benoit, all right?
Okay, thanks.
But yeah, this is so mergeable. This is great.
And I just have a question on the optimization pass. Is there a situation where it would be possible to reorder message sends without breaking the causal order granted.
To reorder message sends. That's interesting. You would have to know. No, not well. You would have to know whether there was. Let's say you were sending messages to. You can't reorder your messages to some actor A1, right? But you might be able to reorder your sends to A1 and A2. But you could only do so if you knew that there wasn't a causal dependency, that A1 must have received its message before A2 responds to your message by sending a message to A1.
Yeah, you have to do some kind of static analysis to check that the graph doesn't converge again, right?
Yeah.
Wait, why?
So imagine there are three actors, Alice, Bob, and Charlie.
Uh-huh.
Alice sends a message to Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Then Alice sends a message to Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
In response to the second message, Charlie sends a message to Bob. Mm-hmm. Bob is guaranteed to get Alice's message before Charlie's message. In the absence of static analysis, there's no way to say that we can reorder and allow Alice to send the message to Charlie before the message to Bob.
That was tired Sean going, wait, what? I'm like, oh, right, the very first thing, it's sent there first, right, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So yes, if Alice sends to Charlie before Bob, then Bob might receive the message from Alice or the message from Charlie first. There's no ordering guarantee anymore.
Right, yeah, that would mess with a lot of people's heads.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas so you have to prove that the effect of the message to Bob and message to Charlie never, you know, those effects never ran back into each other.
Right.
Informally.
Exactly.
It was only fan out.
Now, if we were to add causal message groups syntactically, then we could do this very, very cheaply. Because you might see that the message to Bob and the message to Charlie were in separate causal groups, or perhaps they were not in causal groups, and then you could definitely reorder.
So this is the causal group feature. Is this something that was intended for distributed pony?
Yeah, exactly. Because in the distributed context, enforcing causality, there's something we're working on, which is really cool, which is tree structured networks, which enforces causality with zero space and log n latency overhead, which is great. This is a really good result for enforcing causality in a distributed context. But that log n latency is something we prefer not to pay when we don't have to, right?
Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah. So if two things are if something is not in any causal group, it can be directly sent to the recipient with no overhead without going through the tree structure network. But I'm still wondering whether causal groups are comprehensible to the programmer or not.
I think that could be difficult, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially gets a little bit tricky, I think, when you start talking about different libraries. Each other.
Yeah. You would certainly need the ability to have they couldn't be numbered. They'd have to have arbitrary names. And you need the ability for a program that uses two libraries to take, obviously those causal groups would be in scope of those packages, right? So they wouldn't be the same causal group, even if they had the same name. But the program would need the ability to say, oh, these two causal groups, I want you to merge them.
Right.
There'd never be a reason to split a causal group. Well, not a useful reason.
Yeah, if you're trying to wreck things at the library. Yeah,
trying to wreck things would definitely be a reason. But there could be a reason to merge them. And I think if you get merge and you get uniqueness, name uniqueness, then I think you have the composability you need. But I don't know if that leaves it as something comprehensible or not.
I know a reason to be able to split them.
Yeah.
Sylvan. Yeah, that way we can have the pony version of like when people like to show off, look, and here I'm going to redefine true and false in Ruby.
The three important values of a Boolean, true, false, and file not found.
Yeah. I mean, the main reason I would think of you would need to split them is just because the library author didn't design them correctly. I mean, I guess we need to talk about the use cases more to figure out, like,
I think under that circumstances, those circumstances, I think that's...
Yeah, fix the library.
Right, yeah. I think you're going to need a fork at that point.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just wondering whether, like, maybe the question that leads to is it, when you talk about, like, the details of how it works out, is it comprehensible for the library author to know how the causal groups need to work? For the user, so can they choose a solution that will work for all their users?
Yeah,
at least all reasonable use cases.
Yeah,
like if you spin up, I'm just thinking of something like where it almost seems like the causal group needs to be something created. I don't know, like say you have like a pool of workers, and they need to be causally grouped, but you want to spin up another pool and run them in parallel, and they're doing work that's unrelated to the first pool. I don't know.
That's quite interesting.
Examples.
Yeah, where actually they're the same by type, but their causal relationship is completely different.
Yeah, like it was as if it was instantiated at runtime.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And then I guess the causal group would have to be passed around like a capability at that point.
Yeah, in fact, even more so because it's actually something that would need to be dynamically discoverable. So that that's a good point.
Long pause. Does that mean next thing?
Next thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I figured that one out today.
Oh, come on. You two are lazy. 2204. This one's still going through CI on Travis, but I think it's reasonable to look at it and sign off. It's code gen mark non-bare functions unnamed _ address, basically. It's Benoit's.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, I just typed, this is good to merge when it passes CI, and when I hit that, it passed CI.
Well, you know what to do then.
Okay then. Alrighty. Thank you, Travis. Boom. Okay. Dun 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 dun. All right, issues. This one has already been marked as ready for work, but I thought I'd highlight it just in case. This is 2198. Matthias found some interesting things going on with character literals while he was working on adding a character literals section to the what's the word I'm looking for? The tutorial. That's the word I'm looking for. So just in case anybody's interested, like Sylvan, did you know all this happened?
I know he was working on some stuff because we had that excellent conversation from before.
Yeah.
An empty character literal is zero. Okay, I can see treating that as invalid syntax. I sort of thought it was fine for it to be zero, but I can also see it being invalid syntax. However, what is that, a fancy reindeer?
That's a pony.
Is it?
Yes, that's a horse.
Awesome. That should definitely not return zero.
What's interesting.
So the use case for multi-character literals is just so that people know, understand that there is one. There are many file formats out there that use a 4-byte encoding that is in fact a multi-character literal. So there are lots of like 3D file formats that encode things, then it spells a little thing. And it's a lot easier in your code to be able to spell the little thing directly. It's not the most brilliant thing to do in a file format, but there are so many of them that exist that being able to express that is kind of nice. And they're not hex encoded. They're actually character literal encoded. And in case anyone's curious, that's actually valid syntax in C. You can do the same thing in C, which many people don't realize.
Okay. Well, with that said, I mean, that's the part that when I marked it as bug ready for work, I was marking it as I was assuming that was an oversight and this was meant to, or that it should only be valid to have character literals that have exactly one byte. But it sounds like we have a, you know, it sounds like that is not something that is established.
So. No, definitely not. No, the interesting thing is that apparently that's a carousel horse. It's a particular horse.
Yes, it is.
So that's 1F3A0. And I sort of, that should decode as 1F3A0, right? That's exactly what it should be. The interesting thing there is, why isn't it doing that? And I wonder if it has to do with where it is in the as a code point. And I wonder if one that was under OXFFFF would decode correctly. I'm not sure.
So it's still a bug. It's just a different sort of bug.
Yes.
Can you add the multi character blah blah etc. comment?
Yeah.
Can you add things to this?
Yeah, doing that right now.
Things. Yes. Deep with the words.
So here's a quick question. Is it possible to detect this? When you talk about file formats, you're talking about like encodings?
Yeah. So like, I can't believe I remember this, but Lightwave happens to encode files that uses this kind of stuff in it.
So is there, I don't know. So within Pony source code, like, so you're talking about like a single, I guess what I'm getting at is I would have an expectation, I guess, from the tutorial and just like, you know, from my familiarity with Pony, like my expectation was that like a character literal is a byte. The thing you said about C is like news to me, I guess. Maybe I should adjust my expectations for that. But, I mean, I'm wondering, like, so if even if some other file formats like include those kinds of things, like, does it make sense for us to have our character literals be multi-byte, or you know, could we just express those as string literals?
No, because that would be a string; it wouldn't be a number.
I guess I'm a little bit fuzzy on the use case for. A Pony literal that is interacting with these file formats. Like, I don't know.
Okay. Well, let me just write a little example here, and maybe it's...
I'm confused about when you would need it to be a number and not a string, if you're dealing with a file.
Yeah. Let me put a little example, and then you... Let's see what you think. sorry, here, just finishing off comment. All right, see what you think of this comment and see if it makes sense to you.
So when you were when you're dealing with that, is there a reason you wouldn't just read out the, like, so in Pony, when you're reading from a file, like let's say you're trying to parse file format, when you're reading from a file, you're reading it in terms of array U8. So I would think that you would,
well, actually normally what you do for a lightwave file is you'd use a writer. You'd use a reader. You definitely use a reader for a lightwave file, and because it encodes numbers in all kinds of interesting ways, like some big endian, some little endian, and so you'd be going through there and you'd say, okay, I need the next chunk, get me a little endian 32-bit value, and then then match on what that is, or switch in the bad old days, and that tells you what the next chunk is.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, in that case, I would probably still lean toward expressing it in hex, but, you know, that's just me. So I think it's fine.
I think this may be, one of those things where I'm just too old for my own good, and this seems normal to me, and maybe it isn't normal. I just expect this to work because C does it and C++ does it and Fortran does it, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily a good idea. Maybe this is a bad idea.
I'm going to stay out of it because I'm also old. older than you.
Yeah.
So but how far does this go? Is it just up to 4 bytes or is it more?
No, it's arbitrary.
Okay.
And it'll do its best to decode the number.
So all the way up to U128.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like yeah. If you just do a web search using your favorite web engine on C multi-character literal, my personal favorite web searcher, DuckDuckGo, brings up an example of a C multi-character literal straight away.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I think it's reasonable for us to say it works like C, unless it's like a feature that people commonly hate in C. You know, I think it's probably okay, as long as if we're not inventing something new. I think it is a little bit weird, but as long as we're not inventing it, you know, if there's a prior work that people are used to in at least one language, I think that's reasonable.
Okay, cool.
I just feel weird to see. Well, it's how C does it. I don't know. That makes me laugh. Anyway. We are at the top of the hour, which means it's time to open it up for, does anybody have anything they would like to bring up?
Yeah, actually, I have a question on the pull request for RFC 46, which is the array swap elements and the random methods.
Yeah, 2128.
I'm just wondering what's holding this back.
Oh, I missed that it was. Oh, Joe was going to add. He was going to add a test.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And
there's a test.
Not for swap out. Yeah, but not for swap elements.
Yeah, there is. And the shuffle does swap elements. And test random shuffle does shuffle.
Wait, what?
In the new test random shuffle, it calls mt.shuffle.
Mm-hmm.
And and mt.shuffle takes an array. It calls array.
Right, but there's a test for random shuffling, right? Which may or may not, which where array swap elements may or may not do the right thing. But it's to still pass, shouldn't it? Or am I wrong on that?
Well, it's on a specific Mersenne Twister seed.
Uh-huh.
So okay. it can only do the one thing. But okay. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's not a valid test. It seems like it is to me. I could have more, I suppose.
I'm willing to concede that one, but it felt to me like swap elements should have a test.
Separate from being used in the other test.
Yes.
I think that's reasonable.
But that was about it, and then that I thought it should have a changelog entry. Because I didn't think that add array swap elements in various random methods would be a great changelog entry for when it popped in.
Yeah.
But that would be the reasons, Theo. Sorry.
Okay.
That's all me. And then Joe had to pop off because he had the thing. And anything else? I feel like there was some other thing that somebody brought up as a thing to discuss, didn't they? During the last week? I thought it was Theo or something. Didn't you have a thing, Theo? Am I delusional?
I don't think I had a thing. I think you're delusional. I think you're tired.
God, well, I know. I'm tired. I felt like
that was extraordinarily well done, Theo.
Oh, that was good. Yeah. Wow, I felt like there was a thing. Does anybody else have anything to go over right now, or should we go back to issues?
Issues is good.
Okay, give everybody another moment, man. Don't just... All right. Okay. So let's do 2196. Tommy McGuire opened one where he was surprised by what happened with reference capabilities and tuples in, look at 2196. We actually worked around this sentence, and I don't remember what we did, and I haven't had a chance to. But yeah, we wrote a queue that takes tuples, but then something. I don't remember. I don't remember.
Yep. Okay, let me go through his actual example here.
Oh, wait, no, so...
Yeah, so it's forcing Val onto the capability for actor.
Yeah, I remember how you've actually fixed this, I think. Or not. No, never mind. I'm sorry. I'm tired.
And this actually brings up a larger question, which is a tuple a record, or is it not a record in the computer science-y way? In the sense that of currently in Pony, a tuple is not a record. The tuple itself doesn't have a reference capability. And so when you say, I'd like to specify a reference capability on a tuple, what it's doing right now is saying, oh, you must mean to splat that capability on every element of the tuple, because they aren't fields.
Yep.
On the other hand, it is also quite reasonable to say, well, tuples should be records. And in fact, that would let us do things like talk about tuples with named elements in a useful way. In which case, tuples should have a reference capability, but that would be a rather large change.
I remember who had something to talk about.
Okay. Was it you?
It was me. I wanted to talk about how it would be really nice if tuples were like records and had named things on them. It would make them much easier to use.
That would be great. Very reasonable thing to say.
So,
and in fact, it turns them into a kind of structurally typed class that is structurally typed over the fields. And we could even get into saying, going further than that, I mean, there's all kinds of things that we could do where we could say that a tuple is both an implicit interface for getters and setters over those fields and an underlying type. There's all kinds of things we could do, but it would mean that there are many places right now where we would need to change the way tuple is being used.
Would there be
you could even go so far as to say that you could write to a tuple's fields? I mean, that's not the usual approach, but there's nothing fundamentally broken about that.
When you say write to its fields, you mean like instead of one and two, you've given them names and you say tuple dot.
I mean, being able to update them as if its fields were var instead of let. Which, yeah, not sure how I feel about that one, but.
Well, I think that would be fine as long as it doesn't do that if the capability of the tuple is val.
Oh, right. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, you absolutely couldn't. But then you also get into the thing of, well, that means a. Yeah, I mean, then I guess you could have a let tuple. You couldn't change the tuple, but could you change its fields? It's a bit. Because an immutable capability, whether it's box or val, would then change the capabilities of the fields. So there's a. Suddenly let becomes. Let fields versus var fields is a separate distinction. Anyway, we could consider all of these things. I think. I think Tommy's point here is absolutely right. It's not quite what we want yet. It's not a bug in the sense that we compromised on this, but I think, yeah, we want some new compromise because he's right. It's not quite right. It would also sort of, if tuples had reference capabilities, it would simplify many things about the type system. In terms of inside the compiler,
I would say the one thing that we want to keep an eye on if we start touching tuples and doing stuff with them is that they are a very nice way to pass information around with less overhead, particularly related to like the garbage collector and whatnot.
That brings up another issue, which is the difference between pass by reference and pass by value.
See, I was setting you up for that one because we already had that other conversation.
Yeah. And I don't think there should be a reason as a random example, C# makes the distinction of pass by type, by reference and pass by value in the type itself. So a class is passed by reference and a struct is passed by value. You can then have a ref to a struct, in which case you pass your struct by reference, but anyway, that's another issue. And I think it would be nicer to say that that's more of a per instance rather than a per type thing. But then we do need to be able to have an idea of what does it mean to pass something by value. It's really simple if it's just a collection of integers, right? But if it's something more complex, it's not as simple. Is it a shallow copy? Is it a deep copy? Does it need to be a user-specified shallow or deep copy? Yeah. Obviously, you can't pass something isolated by value in a straightforward way. That might be something that then the user needs to write for a type. But I do think being able to pass by value in some circumstances, it's a nice optimization. That said, well, anyway, that's something that garbage collection is the main reason for that. And reducing garbage collection pressure would perhaps obviate the need for that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in our code base, we have an awful lot of things where we didn't pass them by classes in order to reduce
GC pressure.
Yep.
Yeah. Definitely. Particularly, I suspect, ORCA messages.
Yeah, I mean, when you're processing, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of messages a second, you know, the difference between wrapping up your four fields in a class and sending it along versus just sending them in a tuple or sending them as individual items gets to be kind of large.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, people can say, oh, it shouldn't be like that, et cetera. But then in the end, you know, computers are as computers are.
Yeah.
My deep thoughts for today.
But somewhere in there, I think, is that's sort of the design space, and somewhere in there is the design point, right?
Yes. Oh, I remembered the other thing that somebody wanted to talk about.
Was it you?
Yes, it was me.
All right, just checking.
Oh, so when we're done with this one, I have another one.
Excellent.
Are we done with this one for right now? Should we put, do you want to put something on Tommy's basically saying, yes, this is not good?
Yeah.
Blah, blah, X, Y, Z, A, B, C, D. Maybe Tommy's listening. Hi, Tommy. We miss you. Come back. Well, apparently he's still doing stuff. He's just doing it silently behind the scenes.
Excellent.
So the other thing that I wanted to talk about, which I tagged this 10 days ago. Oh, and then Matthias said, this is awesome, is I wanted to talk about 267. It's such a small number at this point. So that's the allow finite recursive type aliases. I would really like to see this done. But I really don't know how to go about doing it, and I don't know that too many other people do, Sylvan. And I would love to get information from you captured onto this ticket so that somebody could be able to have a clue of where they would really start and what the issues are on it. Because, like, I dove in, I was like, oh, let's see how this works. I'm like, oh, I see what's going on here, but I would need to spend like probably 2 or 3 days hacking on it before I'd have an idea of how one would even start actually doing this.
Yeah. Which issue number is it again? I'm sorry.
267. It was opened like over 2 years.
A zillion years ago. Yeah.
So, you know, I was like, oh, what's involved with this? And I looked at it and I was like, okay, I see how this is working, but I have no idea how I would start to break this apart. And I think just like that thing which could help somebody pass the, I spent 2 days randomly hacking on this to see what happens as I start breaking it apart. Like, yeah. if we could get that on there, I think that could be potentially really helpful.
Okay.
So yes, I'm gonna send that to you as a reminder, and if you can.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
And I'll leave it tagged on there. Shall we do some other issues?
Sounds good.
All right, I'll leave that on there for now. Let's see. This one was tagged as needs discussion during sync a long time ago. Let's see why. Oh, Benoit, issue 1186. Did you report the LLVM bug?
Which one?
Issue 1186. We last talked about this on May 31st, and you said you were going to open an LLVM bug report.
Oh, in the exception stuff. No, I didn't do it.
Okay, here's your reminder again to do that, and I'll leave this tagged as such for one that we'll eventually come back to.
Yes, again. Thank you.
What's this here? Oh yes, this one got some activity. 1532. This is the automated C linting, style linting for C source code. This got bumped up because I was like, hey, I see that our C code is actually kind of sort of all over the place. And it's also a pain for telling people, hey, X, Y, Z on this. Oh, look, we have an issue for doing linting, maybe reformatting. So I was like, well, this hasn't moved. What about this? And then Token Rove came back with a different one. So I thought it'd be good if we had some ideas on what we might want to use for doing linting or reformatting.
So Clang format is vastly more powerful than all the other C formatters because it actually understands the code being formatted. Mm-hmm. I've never seen this configurator before. It's wicked awesome. I think we could fiddle with it and get something. Yeah. That's very interesting. Oh, wow, this is good. Okay, let me fiddle with this one. This is kind of neat. This is well done. Like, really well done. Also, there's a quite a few options.
Many options.
Yeah.
More options than you can shake a stick at.
Yeah, many, many. Many, many.
Okay, that one was a Paul one. Paul's still not here. That one I haven't been able to make any progress on. Just so folks know, I was given access to a 32-bit BSD machine, and yeah, the stuff in issue 2108 is still there. From what I can see, it looks like it was, in theory, it was supposed to, there are comments that say this should have been fixed in a later version of Clang, but I still had the same problem on the machine when using Clang 4. So really not sure what's going on with that, because there's also stuff which, as Swills points out, that it also looks like there were things where it's like there weren't 8-byte atomic operations on I386 for FreeBSD. So there's a lot of conflicting info out there. If somebody's listening to this and knows FreeBSD more and has any idea and can take a look at 2108, that would be great. So otherwise, I'm taking the needs discussion off of sync from it because I got completely stumped. See, that's also a Paul one that was sitting around waiting. This one was opened 20 days ago, was marked as needs discussion during sync. And let's see, well, let's go over it then. It's 2150, and I think this would be our last one for the day. Gordon opened this. Oh, yes, this one. Why do we still have it marked as needs discussion during sync? Maybe we didn't actually discuss it during sync. Yeah. Is there anything that needs to be added to this, Sylvan? Or is it, at this point, are we looking for where it comes from?
I'm sorry, I was looking at that configurator. I apologize. Which issue?
2150. This one sucks so bad. I hate this one so much. It's the anything which is defined in the body of a trait has to be included at the call at where the trait is used in the class. I hate this one.
Yeah, this is a damn complex thing.
So this is a hard.
Yeah.
Hard, and I think it's bug and it's ready for work, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. And
Joe's nailed it.
Yeah, this would be really nice to fix. So nice. Yeah, and I closed one of ours that we right there. Right. Okay. 8 minutes. I thought I removed the new discussion.
So I think what I'm going to do on this claim formatter is I'll propose one because this is so good.
Mm-hmm.
And then people can say, no, you're insane, and propose alternate ones. And then eventually, hopefully, we settle on one and that's it.
Okay.
We can run claim format on all our code.
All right. Here, I'll tell you this right now. Okay.
Okay.
I agree with whatever you say. I really don't care as long as there's a thing that we can run on it so that people can contribute code and we can just have it run and boom, it does its thing. And we don't have to do a C style guide and tell people, no, do this.
Yeah. That's great.
I can't believe I've gone from 5 years ago from code formatters are the worst thing ever, which I think Joe is still in that general area, to, yeah, sure, do whatever. Just as long as people can like contribute and nobody like bike sheds and gets into arguments.
Fair enough.
All right. One more. This was opened 20 days ago, 2153 by Gordon. Compiler asserts on if type.
Sorry, I was doing it again. 2153?
Yes. If type is still experimental at this point. Yes. I think
it's pretty good.
I think I said it should be documented in a tutorial and then Joe said it's still experimental.
That's fair.
Or maybe Benoit said that. So, but not.
It's getting awfully good. But this is clearly a bug. Yeah.
But one that we need investigation on because who knows? Yes. Does anybody know off the top of their head why this might happen? I certainly don't.
This is strange because it's failing in a X local ref, and it's sitting in assertion failure in type run current inner. Is it possible for local type to be not a type run ref, not a nominal, not a union intersection, no tuple, and not a narrow? Is there any other type that local could be or could contain? Because right now,
But I guess we're going to need to run this and
find out what it is.
Yeah, probably.
Apparently the answer is yes.
But that's a good point. Not that I can think of, but that, yeah.
So yeah, needs investigation.
Okay.
All right. Okay. I'm going to say that's good for this time, although we have a few more from needs discussions from previous times. I think that's a good one. Let's see who marked this as. Oh, wait. Hold on. Okay, let's do one more because Benoit marked it as needs discussion. Benoit, after Joe's comments, is there anything to go over for 2182?
Yeah, I think we should discuss the what Joe says about discriminating capabilities on type parameters, but I think that would take quite a long time, so I think it would be better to leave it for another time.
I'll leave that for this time, and we can tackle it next time. Okay, all right. Unless anybody has anything, I'm going to call it with 3 minutes early.
Okay.
Boop 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 boop. Okay. All right. And I'm